for that. Steve is the Honourable Peter's Comps Chair of Social Technology at the University of Wales. He's written countless articles and books, particularly on the history of philosophy and sociology of science. My particular favourite is Thomas Kuhn, Philosophical History for Our Times. His most recent project is called Humanity 2.0, which develops his thinking about the impact of science and technology on our understanding of what it is to be human and what prospects that holds for the future. The title for today's talk is The Story of Neoliberalism They Never Told You About. So,
first of all, the real reason why I'm here is to make sure Nick comes back to Warwick at the end. Okay, just so we're all clear about this. But first of all, I want to thank Chris for inviting me on such short notice. I'm in this part of the world now because yesterday I keynoted the British Sociological Association conference, and so I figured, you know, why not gate crash this thing? But also, neoliberalism has been a very kind of long-standing concern of mine, and I think at some point I'm actually going to write something substantive on the topic. But what I want to do today is actually to lay out what I think are kind of the interesting considerations. And I was really glad with the way in which the introductions were made, because we're talking about here something that has very deep historical roots. There's no doubt about it. This is not just something that began with Reagan and Thatcher, but at the same time is something that, the farther back you go, and the deeper you go into looking at the roots of neoliberalism, frankly, I think the more potential you see for bringing out something that could be regarded as positive. Okay, and so let me put that on the table at the moment, that those of you who come in thinking that neoliberalism is an unequivocally negative thing, I disagree with this. Okay, I think it's a much more mixed story, and I think this is where kind of a richer history in a way exposes you to kind of a wider range of background sources that one might want to draw upon. And so since as the first speaker, I'll take advantage of the fact and start in the beginning. And for me, I'm going to trace the beginning back to the Enlightenment, and in particular, I'm going to be drawing a bit on a book that some of you may know about by Emma Rothschild, Economic Sentiments, which came out about 10 years ago now with Harvard University Press, which is about basically trying to give a rather rich picture of the sort of classical political economy that was being put forward in the late 18th century by Adam Smith and Condorcet. And the interesting thing about her book is that she considers the two figures together. I don't think that's usually the case, because they're usually somewhat associated with somewhat different ideological movements, roughly liberalism versus socialism. But if we're talking about the 18th century context, where what we're seeing is a general disaffection and revolt against a kind of paternalistic Tory politics, okay, they're both on the same side. Okay, and let's see, what does this Tory paternalistic politics look like? This is the kind of thing that, in fact, somebody like Karl Polanyi in The Great Transformation, if you're familiar with that book from the 1940s, that he presents in a mildly positive light, actually, because he's sort of against marketization and the way in which markets have destroyed bonds of community and so forth. And so he presents a relatively positive picture of the thing that Smith and Condorcet were against. And what they were against was the idea that, in a sense, people's expectations of what people can be were being too much determined by what they have been in the past. And what they've been in the past has been reinforced, not only through sort of the legal system, whereby most of wealth and everything was and careers and occupations were being transmitted hereditarily. So there is this very close kind of linking between the legal and the biological, you might say, that was going on. But also a sort of general kind of fear that actually if you let people kind of try to decide what they want and so forth, that this might lead to anarchism and chaos. And there was already precedent for that with regard to the Protestant Reformation. Okay? Because Protestantism actually led to an enormous amount of chaos, and you know about the English Civil War, which was just, you know, in the 17th century. And so in the 18th century, these are things to be concerned about after the Restoration. Okay? And so this was the kind of thing that was grounding the kind of general kind of presumed Tory worldview that we see in the 18th century, against which liberalism, in the first instance, but socialism also, were revolting against. And it's in this context that Smith and Condorcet enter the picture. Now, one of the ways in which this kind of Tory paternalism, you might say, was manifested was in terms of enormous amount of what we would call economic protectionism. Right? That is to say that there would be certain kinds of, it's an idea that begins in the Middle Ages with the guilds and so forth, but basically certain kind of, as it were, privileged providers. Right, state privileged providers for various kinds of goods, and they would have certain privileges with regard to trading and so forth, and these were often things that had been handed down from previous kings and so forth. And so it was very difficult for anyone to kind of get any leverage economically to come up with anything kind of new or to get, or even amass wealth, unless one could work through those channels. Okay? And so this is the kind of context that I think you have to sort of initially see this kind of liberalism speaking into. I think for most people of the society of the time, it was probably very secure, actually, in terms of what was expected and social arrangements and so forth. But from the standpoint of people who, for various reasons, political, metaphysical, whatever, thought human beings were capable of more, okay, and we could have a discussion about that, right? It becomes then necessary to create new social conditions under which that moreness can be displayed. Okay, and this is where we start to get the idea that states ought to create markets. That markets aren't just things that sort of naturally emerge when there is a kind of surplus, right? I mean, because if you think about the historical, origins of markets and the way in which, let's say, somebody like Aristotle justifies the existence of markets in the classical political economy, classical ancient Greek political economy, right? The idea is that markets aren't things that have, as it were, self-sustaining existence, but rather are things that just sort of emerge at points where there are, within a community, there seem to be deficits and surpluses with regard to goods and services that can then be traded to clear the market. And so that's where a market was associated very much with a particular place where the goods were traded, and then end of story. Market wasn't a concept, right, let alone the guiding concept of what the economy was about. But in the 18th century, we actually start to get this idea that it might be a good idea to have a kind of guiding idea of a market. And that in some sense, the market as a concept might be a way in which human potential might fully flourish. Okay? And Condorcet, of the two thinkers, Smith and Condorcet, Condorcet is actually the one who I think has a kind of better kind of take, or at least more sophisticated take, on this idea of the market, where a state, rather than just, as it were, enabling just a certain kind of privileged group of privileged providers to provide goods, what one would do is open it up to competition, both at the producer end and the consumer end, right? So you have something approximating a free market, and what this would entail would be that everyone involved would have to smarten up their act. One of the main reasons, perhaps the main reason, is because choice, proliferation of choice, right? I mean, one of the things that Condorcet especially points out about the sort of decadence of the kind of mercantile sort of system that existed in France, and Smith complains about this too, is the fact that everybody becomes kind of lazy in a way, right? Because you have a certain limited number of producers and they can kind of get away with what they want to do, okay? And you have a limited number of consumers, and so they don't have to be very discriminating or they don't have to think very hard about anything. And so it's all just kind of perfectly matched, right? You get some kind of pre-established harmony, and no one's really ever stretched to sort of think beyond what is actually going on at the moment. And so to get people to think in a more sophisticated, more nuanced fashion, to encourage innovation, as we would say today, one would need a market environment. Okay, so in other words, no one is protected. So in other words, everyone actually has to compete, both the producers and the consumers. And through that mutual interaction that takes place, once you start to proliferate producers and consumers, you get a kind of collective learning experience, which the people in the Austrian tradition, right, of the economy in the 19th and 20th century like to think about the price mechanism this way. Okay, but the idea is actually there in Condorcet. It's basically a kind of collective learning strategy. And Condorcet, where he differs, of course, from all those Austrian guys like Hayek and so forth, is that Condorcet also imagined, very much in the kind of Enlightenment model, right, that there would be a state right, that would not just, as it were, set up the markets, but as it were, gather up the consequences, gather up the results, gather up the findings, and feed it back into the system. There'd be kind of like a feedback loop, a second order, as it were, kind of intelligence that's created. And that's the intelligence, right, that would enable the Enlightenment to become kind of a vehicle of widespread social transformation. Okay? And so that's the part of the story that in fact drops out when we start moving into Austrian economics in the 19th and 20th century, largely having to do with what a lot of people had interpreted over the course of the period between Condorcet, you know, so between like 1750 and 1900, let's say, this kind of disillusionment with the French Revolution and what it accomplished, right? Because the French Revolution in many ways was seen as kind of a this kind of moment where there was an opportunity to actually test some of these more radical kind of Enlightenment ideas, and some of the people who were leading the French Revolution were in fact endorsing a lot of this stuff openly, and then you see the consequence, and there's all this disaster, and then you get a reinstitution of the monarchy, and then you go to the middle of the 19th century, the 1848 revolutions, same problem all over again, it seems like another kind of moment of liberalism, and then it all kind of collapses. And so there's a whole group of people who start to think about this in terms of a problem with the state, right? That the state can't really be trusted with all of this knowledge and power and so forth. And that's where you get the Austrian economics position, where you basically have a complete sort of skepticism about the possibility of any kind of second-order knowledge about society, let alone something that could be the basis of a kind of administrative science of the kind, let's say, a lot of us in sociology fancy in some way, and certainly was very much present at the founding of sociology with regard to Saint-Simon and Comte. Okay, and it's the failures of those kinds of attempts. But I think the one thing that is worth saying about the Enlightenment and how the Enlightenment could have led to something like the French Revolution is that guys like Condorcet, I think quite explicit, and I think this is true of certainly of the French guys, they had a pretty hard nosed about human beings. They were pretty hard-nosed about human beings. So the idea here was that when we kind of, as it were, release you from the farms and we release you from all of the other bounds of legal bounds that in the past have prevented you from enabling to prove yourself in the market, you're put under a test. Right? We're freeing you to be tested in a sense. Right? And there's not going to be like a fallback position, because the great thing about the Tory paternalism was at the end of the day you were defined by, you know, where you came from, who's been licensing you and stuff like that. But with what you see with the kind of liberalism that the Enlightenment started to promote, all of those kind of safety nets start to drop out. And so the way you prove yourself as a human being in terms of potential is by actually going out there and doing something. And so they're quite willing to take Homo sapiens as kind of, you know, a living experiment where some survive and some will not. Okay, so this is not the welfare state of the 20th century. This is why, I mean, I don't think it was so hard for it to sort of slide in the direction it did, was because at the end of the day, on the one hand, there was an enormous amount of faith in what human beings could accomplish if left to be free, but also the human beings themselves, once, you know, made free, would have to take responsibility for what they do. Both of those things go together. Okay? And I think one of the things that you might say about the welfare state, you know, in the 20th century, the way in which it kind of makes a substantive improvement over what the Enlightenment was on about, was this idea of trying to think about how do you protect people from worse consequences, how do you anticipate the worst consequences, and a lot of social policy-based research, of course, has been about that. Okay, and that's in a sense, one would think of that as kind of a much more humane way of implementing the Enlightenment project, which I think if you were there in the 18th century, and this is one of the reasons, you know, it was a pretty harsh thing that was being recommended, I have to say. And it was part of it was this enormous belief that if you let people free, they will manage to sort things out. They will compete in the market well, they will be able to organize themselves well, and so forth. Okay? And it's the failure, you see, now it's the failure of that in the first instance, starting with the French Revolution, that then gets people to kind of reconceptualize what are we talking about here when we talk about liberalism. All right? And so neoliberalism comes into the picture as a way of trying to salvage something of this idea, right? But actually having a fairly strong state steer. I think there's no mistake about it. Anyone who thinks that neoliberalism is just about laissez-faire, forget about it. right? Neoliberalism is just as, you know, directed in terms of its orientation to the economy as any kind of socialist regime is, right? It just organizes the planning differently, okay? And I think that's a very, very important point here. I mean, so the idea here being that, yes, just like in the 18th century, there is this kind of breakup of monopolies and things like this. And this is where higher education becomes a very interesting situation. I mean, one of the things I was mentioning in response to a question yesterday at the BSA, because people brought up this issue of neoliberalism in higher education, I think you really need to see the development of this historically. And it's not by accident that Lionel Robbins, who was the author of this great report in the 1960s that created universities like this and my own and all the rest of them, right, all these 1960s, very social science-based, kind of interdisciplinary sort of universities, right, part of the motivation for doing that, right, was to break the kind of monopoly that Oxford and Cambridge had, where still, you know, more traditional forms of knowledge were paramount. Okay, and so the idea was you would sort of open up the higher education market, not just in terms of enabling more people to go in there, but also to allow a wider range of subjects to gain prominence, right, in a world where we imagine that actually you're going to need lots of different forms of knowledge in order to survive. Now, this was the Robbins who 30 years earlier hired Hayek at the London School of Economics. The same Robbins, okay, and Robbins didn't go through some kind of, oh, I used to be a socialist and now I'm a, you know, capitalist or whatever. And it was none of that. It's the same ideas. Same ideas applied in different domains. Okay? And if you look at the pluralization of universities that took place in 92 and throughout the period, there's always been this kind of neoliberal thing going on. Okay? I mean, the tuition fee thing is new. But certainly the idea of creating lots of universities and trying to get lots of people in, you know, higher education and trying to enable conditions under which new forms of knowledge can emerge to compete with older forms of knowledge, that's always been there. That was always part of that. That is part of what neoliberalism tries to do. Now, one of the things that the neoliberal state, once we get the state back into play, right, in the 20th century, one of the things that it takes a very strong interest in, and this is where I think, if you want to say, what is it that you want to trace, if you want to trace the history of the state's role in neoliberalism, is the idea of the cultivation of human capital. Right? Because in a sense, that's what the state's business is. Right? The state isn't in the business of protecting people against themselves or something like that. Right? So it doesn't have a welfarist function, but it has a kind of almost like agricultural function. Right? It wants to raise human capital, so it's productive. Right, because if it's productive, then you'll have more activity happening in markets, right, and we'll all live happily ever after. Okay, so the idea, what the state wants to do is to encourage human capital. Now, it's not going to do that by, as it were, reverse genetically engineering people or something like that. So it's not going to do it in the very specific kind of way. But what it's going to do is it's going to allow various sorts of markets, as it were, to force people to train themselves up, so they can actually be productive. And how do you know people are productive? Because other people want to buy what they're selling. It's as simple as that, and it applies across all domains. How much more time do I have? I don't want to go...
Up to 10 minutes.
Okay. See, I'm presenting this picture to you because I do think that you got to sort of see, you know, scope out what all this is about. And one of the things that I didn't say about Lionel Robbins was that before he became the head of the economics department at the London School of Economics, where he brought in Hayek and a lot of other people who we now call neoliberals, he was a Fabian socialist. Okay? And I want to put that into the mix, because that's very important for a sort of larger set of issues, and Chris is interested in these things, about the context in which one should be thinking about social policy. Because I really think that neoliberalism, I mean, what I think one of the big mischaracterizations of neoliberalism is that it's short-termist. I think that's a big mischaracterization. You would not have overhauled the higher education system in the amount of detail that it's been done over a short period of time if you only had short-term goals. You could cause more misery much more quickly, much more easily. There's actually a long-term plan here, okay? There's a plan. And this is like, you know, if you think about the Soviet Union, there's a plan, right? There'll be some, you know, no pain, no gain. And I really do think you have to think about neoliberalism as very much having very long-term horizons about the transformation of society. And this is why, for example, you know, those of you who are old enough to remember when Margaret Thatcher was alive, everybody hated her guts, and now she's a saint. Right? Because 25 years pass, new people come on the scene, you start to see the fruits of all these transformations that were made, people start to say, ah, Britain maybe is better off, blah, 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 right? And that's exactly what we're talking, that's exactly the horizon, right? So in a sense, it is part of also an outgrowth of a very long-termist horizon, right? Where as it were, the effects that you, so even though we're talking about the markets at the as the instruments, the primary instruments of social transformation, right? And markets are things that in a sense clear their products, you know, day after day after day, right? So there is a kind of short term, you can see the effects of markets, prices change, all that kind of stuff. Nevertheless, the reason why you're doing it, the kind of the framework in which you're doing it, the institutional framework in which you're doing it is incredibly long term, is because you're actually trying to transform people. And I think, you know, this is where some of the deep objections to neoliberalism are correct in a way. The superficial ones might not be so correct, but the deep, there's a sense, yes, we want different people here. We want people who can compete, because competing is what it is to be a human being. Okay? So this is the thing, right? So those deeper, kind of more ontological questions about what, you know, what people are here for, you know, what's the point of having people, right? I think there, yes, I think a lot of those sort of deep criticisms, right, that get made, you know, like the marketization of everything in some ways transforming us to be people we don't want to be, dehumanizing us, whatever, there's some truth to that, and it's deliberate. I don't think anyone who's ever defended this kind of neoliberalism policy has ever denied this. Okay? So neoliberalism, you might say, is the exact opposite of what you might call compassionate conservatism. Right? It's the exact opposite. Okay? It's kind of liberalism on steroids with the state backing it. Okay? And I think that's the, and I do think it is a legitimate heir to the Enlightenment in this respect, okay? And also it is a legitimate heir to a certain way of thinking about what it is to try to, you know, one of the goals of Fabian socialism, which it shared with the Russian, you know, the Bolshevik socialism, was this idea that part of what politics needs to do is to transform human beings, make them better. Right? That is one of the roles of politics. And the economy is the primary lever you've got to do it. And then the question becomes, how do you organize the economy to enable this social transformation to occur? And here is where the difference occurs. The difference occurs at that level, right? Namely, how does the economy need to be organized to affect this kind of major social transformation? But in both cases, in both the Fabian case, which in the case of Robbins and a lot of these other guys who eventually became part of, I'm sure somebody's going to talk about this, the Mount Pelerin Society. I'm not sure who's going to talk about it, but I'm taking for granted someone's going to talk about it, so I don't want to talk about it. Are you familiar with the Mount Pelerin Society? This is a kind of a club that was developed in the 1940s, an outgrowth of a lot of people who liked Walter Lippmann, the American journalist. And it's basically where neoliberalism was incubated for about a generation or two before it actually had a lot of political force around the world. Okay, but maybe somebody else is going to talk about that. But the point here is long-term strategy, right? But just like the Bolsheviks, the Fabians had a long-term strategy, and a lot of these Fabians, you know, migrated into what became this kind of neoliberal movement. So the idea here was, it is just as normative in its orientation, it is just as concerned about some kind of utopian vision of what human beings are, but it is organized around radically different principles with regard to the economy in particular, largely because of a different sense of what it means to realize human potential. Okay, and I do think one of the big differences here too, and this is what maybe an interesting kind of point, and maybe one of the reasons why especially people from the left have a problem with neoliberalism, is that those of us on the left tend to have a realist view about normative ideals. In other words, even if we don't know what it is, there's something already out there. Right, and we can't maybe identify it positively, but we certainly can tell when things aren't it. Okay, and so neoliberalism isn't it. Now, neoliberalism, it seems to me, operates from an anti-realist perspective with regard to normative ideals. In other words, there is no ideal in a sense. Right, there is a kind of conception of what human beings ought to be doing, but what kind of a world they organize for themselves once they have been fully realized, it's up to them. And so almost anything is acceptable. Okay? And I do think that, it's in these alternative visions of the end state. And it's one of the things that I think makes a lot of people on the left think, not just on the left, but of course people on the conservative, the traditional conservative side, think of neoliberalism as kind of, without morals, without ethics, just, letting things happen, all of that kind of stuff. Because to a certain extent, it is like that. It kind of advocates a kind of open-ended, anti-realist view toward normativity. Okay? And the idea here is what you want to do, what the state needs to do, is to basically put people in the optimal position to use whatever resources they've got to get as far as they can in whatever that race turns out to be as they interact with each other. So it's like, it is anti-realist all the way down. Okay? This is why, neoliberalism is kind of the closet philosophy of all social constructivists. Okay? I think that's fair. Alfred Schütz. Okay, Alfred Schütz is your man. If you want to see the connection, Alfred Schütz, some of you may be familiar with him. He was a phenomenologist, a sociological phenomenologist, did some work with Max Weber, and was part of this circle in Vienna with Mises and Hayek and people like that, right, prior to the rise of Nazism, and became this very, really big deal in American sociology after the war. And he was the guy who taught Peter Berger, of Berger and Luckman fame, The Social Construction of Reality. And if you look at that book is basically kind of ontologized neoliberalism. But people often think of this as, this is very left, etc. Well, maybe it is in a sense. It's of that left that in a sense has distinguished itself from what we normally call the socialist left. Okay? I think maybe I should stop here and take questions? What do you think?
Yeah.
All right? Okay, I've just been trying to sketch out sort of areas that I've been working on myself. There's many more things that I could say maybe you'd want to raise, but I wanted to kind of get, as it were, sort of the, where I think this whole issue is coming from in the beginning. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Steve. Okay, questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, you started your talk by saying that neoliberalism isn't all bad, that there's, if you think about it historically, there's something positive you can find in the project. But I didn't get a sense of what exactly that positive thing would be. Is it epistemological? Is it political? Is it social? What is it?
I think it's ontological, frankly. I think neoliberalism presupposes an enormously plastic conception of human beings. In other words, the ability of human beings to kind of self-organize, to adapt to various circumstances, to be something other than they've been in the past. I think that kind of plasticity is actually quite positive, and it's one of the things that I think made people very attracted to the Enlightenment image initially. If you think about the contrast with the sort of Tory paternalism, where what you are is what you're born into. So I think it's an ontological thing at the end of the day. A certain kind of view that human beings are open-ended.
And what would the implications be of that ontological view for the left, then, if you wanted to find something positive in that neoliberal project?
Well, this is the tricky part. I mean, because I do think one of the things that neoliberalism tolerates, and it doesn't advertise it, but it tolerates it certainly, is I think they like, creative destruction, right? So in other words, all these boom and bust cycles, all these financial crises, all these, things we go through, for them, these are cleansing exercises, basically, right? These are, opportunities for people to kind of, get their act together, and figure out where they're going, right? They're sort of normative call to arms for each individual to decide for themselves. And I think there's something kind of mildly attractive about that, actually, if you can live through it. I mean, it's the thing, right? I mean, to go back to what I was saying about Condorcet and the original Enlightenment, right? It was, the image of human beings that was presented as so nice, at the end of the day, if you look at the detail, it was a sink or swim strategy, right? In other words, put in this kind of indefinite situation with lots of uncertainties and lots of risk, you either seize the opportunities and succeed, or you fail. And Condorcet's point, yeah, there'll be a lot of failures, but as long as the state kind of keeps track of the fail, and we learn something from the process, then the people in the future will actually be able to benefit from the mistakes made in the past. And I think, in general, and this was done, obviously with a kind of eye towards science as the way in which we should be doing politics. And I think there's some sense to this, actually, right? I do think there's some sense to this idea. I mean, I think one of the problems is that it's so difficult to discuss these matters openly without people getting scared. Okay? But I do think, all the people who've always been worried that, neoliberalism will just allow people to flounder and die and all that, well, there's a certain truth to that. But there is a kind of metaphysical foundation to it, and it does go to the issue about what do you think human beings are at the end of the day. And I think these neoliberals had a pretty optimistic view about what human beings could be. It's just they don't believe everybody could be that. Okay?
What should those do?
What?
What should those do who can't be happy in the little order you just described?
Well, let me tell you, I mean, this is, there's so many ways to go on this. One is to let them die, of course, or starve or something like that. But, you know, this is where the issue of cultivating human capital and where that kind of idea went in the 1920s and 30s, right? I don't know how many of you are familiar with Irving Fisher. Does that name mean anything? Anyone here? You would know. But okay, Irving Fisher was an American economist who was very closely tied with the American Progressive Movement, who coined the phrase human capital in the 1920s. And this was part of a kind of eugenics, right? Human capital, you know, eugenics, that's how you would think of that. Was the original way of thinking about it. And if you look at even people like Gary Becker, okay, the human capital book from the 1960s, the kinds of things that he's showing, you know, where human capital makes a difference and so forth, if you just plotted those curves 50 years ago, you know, they would have been eugenic things, okay? But they're not talked about. There's no biological reference being made, but it's pretty much things that would have been thought of as being tracked biologically. And I think the issue here, John Maynard Keynes, for example, weighed in on this kind of stuff because this is, of course, before the period before neoliberalism is so closely so clearly defined as different from welfare state thinking, right? So if we're talking about the 1920s and 30s, where basically all these guys who were kind of liberal capitalist economists of a sort, but different from the Marxist socialists, right? So you draw that distinction, right? Keynes believed that for people who were unlikely to have either not much human capital or be able to cultivate it very much, they should be actually given a reasonable lifestyle that actually should be insured, but in return for not reproducing. Okay? And you have this policy. This policy was in Sweden. I mean, all the controversies in Scandinavia concerning sterilization in the 20th century were very much done with that kind of mentality, right? So in a sense, you're not going to let the people die. That would be inhumane. But what would also be inhumane is to allow them to reproduce. So you cover both sides. You take care of the people in their lifetimes, but you make sure that this issue doesn't arise again.
Just stop me, we've got a queue of questions.
Yeah, sure, sorry, I didn't mean...
Well, first of all, thank you for stimulating a kind of rethink about neoliberalism. And I kind of see, I think the idea of having a long delay approach to it mm-hmm. makes sense. How I have to say, in having done so, I think you've given rather too many hostages to fortune.
Well, that's the idea.
I just wonder, for the sake of discussion,
sure.
I hope you won't take this as being negative. I could flag some of them up. You consistently use the term the Enlightenment in the singular.
Yeah.
I don't think any serious intellectual historian of that period, or indeed its immediate aftermath, now would do that. They would talk about the many Enlightenments. And you have selected in
yes.
order to produce an attractive argument and an indeed.
But didn't you think I'd give enough flags as to what I was talking about?
And I think there are two things that would need to be thought about alongside your version of England. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and you pick Smith and Condorcet. Well, you know, I could give you a number of other people and say, why don't you pick them?
Sure, sure.
Okay. Particularly, I think, within the Scottish Enlightenment, where there was a much
Oh, that's different,
more,
yeah.
There's a much that's more different. Nuanced debate about humanity, about it isn't just the polar of floating free...
They weren't as ambitious as Condorcet.
Okay, well, that's... Okay. You prefer the put down, but I think there are two themes that perhaps need teasing out which were not very visible in your presentation. One of which was around power, because all this stuff about competition and who succeeds and fails is also about the power who made the decisions. I mean, you know, the guys who talk complacently about, well, we'll deal with the failures somehow, of course, are never the guys who are going to be in the failure queue.
Sure.
Okay, and I think we have to
That's
talk
true.
About the unequal power.
That's true.
And that there are some Enlightenment thinkers who try to struggle towards grappling with that, and out of that is actually going to come certain kinds of what would now be, okay, labelled in a hostile way as leftist thinking, that power needs to be mm-hmm. challenged or modified. But the other more obvious bit is about the emancipatory side of freedom, mm-hmm. which isn't simply about freeing all individuals to compete against mm-hmm. other individuals, but about freeing other kinds of freedoms. Why do you think the issue of slavery was so central?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, even though actually very few Enlightenment thinkers got their act together to oppose slavery in practice, they all opposed it pretty much in principle. Mm-hmm. So a few exceptions. The other hostage fortune you gave was that your analysis was gender blind.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stopping blocks from the ultimate individualism that you're talking about is the thinking of the family.
Yes.
As a resource that you do not interfere with. And in saying, and in doing that, and in not confronting it, and I mean, I can cite you lots of things that show how this works, they produce an actually a very distorted idea about human potential, which is in some ways either gender blind or gender biased or bits of both, and don't factor in any intelligent way household, family, economy, state.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I want to throw out is you made a very commendable gesture against Anglocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me when you were talking about the issues of education as being one of the means through which human potential would be released, you didn't think about the very different track of a continental European world in which the state's role in forming the citizen is understood as being partly about education. In fact, you didn't say much about the debate on citizenship at all.
No, I did yesterday, but you weren't there.
Which I deeply regret, because I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah.
The sort of Anglo tradition, which didn't feel the need to establish, you know, which was very, very reluctant for the state to come in on the education front. So I just think those are things that we might all pick up. But to me, they seem to be bits where unless we pay attention to them, your argument isn't quite as persuasive as you think.
Okay, well, let me just fill in some gaps then, and then you can, because you are raising some issues I didn't talk about, but I have some things to say about. The thing here is, in a way, bringing the power and the family issue together. If you look, one of the things that I think unites, let's say, the Fabian socialists and a lot of, and certainly people in the Enlightenment, any of this movement that was anti-conservative, basically, in the modern period, was a kind of basic belief, that this is true even the founding of sociology. Sociology is kind of constructed around this idea that the primary traditional source of power is the family, and it's through inheritance. And in a sense, if you want to change society, you've got to blast that. You've got to blast hereditary forms of transmission, right? Whether they be through the family or through entitlement that goes from one generation to another, let's say of a firm with regard to licenses from the king, right? That you have to blast that. And that's in fact been always on the, that's been the, seen as the primary source of power, especially in the negative sense of holding people back, has been inheritance. Okay, and this is something that's really consistent across a lot of these people, both on the liberal and socialist side, is ways of trying to either tax inheritance, prevent inheritance from going through, and things of that kind in order to open up each new generation to a new world. Okay, now, having said that, and by the way, this is true, of course, of the founding of eugenics as well. If you go back to Francis Galton, where Francis Galton, the eugenics idea was he's being very upset about House of Lords. Right, where some smart guy ends up enabling all of his descendants, no matter how imbecile they are, to be able to have something to say in the government, right? It's to break, break that was one of the motivations for actually establishing eugenics, okay? So, I mean, because I realize people, I don't know how much you guys study eugenics, but I guess there is this stereotyping that somehow eugenics would reinforce traditional hereditary modes of succession, whereas on the contrary, eugenics was about interfering in a very direct way to actually find out where the talent was, because it wasn't by default being transmitted hereditarily. So there was a lot of wasted human potential because people didn't have the opportunities to be in the places where they could show it. Okay? And that's all part of the same mentality. But having said all that, the one point I will concede here is that gender is not playing a role. So in other words, you could be very critical of the family, very critical of inheritance, and still be very gender blind about the whole issue. And I think that is true for the most part. Okay? I do think that is true. So I'll grant you that. The other thing I want to, about the education thing, just for a moment. I know, the thing I talked about yesterday that bears on this point is when, the framing of my talk was around the subject of his book, actually, which is the establishment of the chair of sociology at the LSE in 1907. Okay, and I was talking about H.G. Wells' candidacy for the job. And the thing was, though, That the whole point of having an LSC, okay, this is the thing, the whole point of having an LSC was to actually train the next generation of civil servants, policymakers, whatever, right, who would be the leaders of society. And these guys, you know, the Webbs, were taking their marching orders to a certain extent from Germany, right, where they had this very well-developed university system and civil service system and something like that, and they wanted to import to a certain extent that kind of model into Britain. Okay, that was part of what was going on there. So these guys who established the LSC did have an eye to these continental things that you're talking about, actually. Okay, and of course it's had some, you know, it had some success in this regard, but not completely. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I guess just...
There you are.
sound here. It's a focus, it's a slightly different focus, I guess, on what John, something John asked about, which is about where in your story you see power, or to put it a bit, I suppose, a bit more specifically, what you would say about monopolies.
Yeah.
The power of monopolies.
Oh, well.
Which seem to be... an obstacle to an account of there being an obstacle to the coherence of the story you're telling. So I take it that, you know, you haven't stood up to defend neoliberalism, and mustn't be mistaken for doing that, but you are suggesting there is something attractive and presumably perhaps coherent.
Yes.
And I suppose I wondered about monopoly power.
You know, this is a excellent question. Make a plug for a former colleague of mine, William Davies, has a new book out on the history of neoliberalism, where he actually focuses on this issue because they flip-flop, basically. Mm. Right? Because the official position ought to be they should be against monopolies. Right? Monopolies are, just like the monopoly was the devil for Condorcet, it should also be the devil in the 20th century. But in fact, over the course of the 20th century, their views change on the matter, and they actually enabled corporations to acquire enormous wealth and things like this. And I think a lot has to do with the extent to which these guys ended up trusting the state to actually intervene, right? Because as companies become more and more expansive and have more and more capital, right, the role that the state would have to perform in a capitalist society to kind of cut them down to size, as it were, becomes much more interfering. And so there was a kind of debate within this community about at what point then you just end up strangling, as it were, the capitalist impulse. And I think that the dominant position ended up being one that was tolerant of monopolies, I think, to make your point. But that's a real issue in the 20th century with regard to this movement. I would say, in a sense, you know, from the standpoint of policy, that's the central incoherence, right? Is the long-term tolerance of monopolies? Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. I just wanted to come back to your original point about neoliberalism's ontology, and you mentioned how it involves sort of an account of creative destruction, and as well treats humans as plastic, as well as changeable. But that seemed to be slightly in tension with the point you made about the long-term project of neoliberalism, which suggested there was some sort of order, some sort of political ordering going on as well. And I think maybe those two could be brought together in the sense that to understand the response to the most recent crisis, for example, yes, creative destruction might be there, and yes, the plasticity and malleability of the human experience might be there as well, but it's channeled into very specific social sectors. So if you take the UK, for example, what was the response to the crisis? One of the principal responses was quantitative easing.
Yeah.
Effectively channeled £600 million pounds to asset holders.
But not all neoliberals were on side with this. Not all neoliberals agreed with this.
That might be true, but it was the predominant response to the British state.
Sure, you're right.
And at the same time, you have real wage decline of 8.7%, unprecedented since the late 19th century. So it might be true that it's ontologically it's committed to this idea of disruption and changeability, but it seems to me you need to take more seriously the way that the neoliberal state channels those processes into different privileged and deprivileged sectors.
No, I agree. Look, I mean, one of the things, of course, that one always has to recognize is that when an ideology, as it were, gets into power, right, there is going to be a lot of issues that kind of get negotiated that maybe even challenge the fundamental principles of the thing. I mean, this is not new. This is not unique to neoliberalism either, by the way. Right, Marxism, same sorts of problems. I mean, I think the value of trying to articulate the neoliberal ideal, to be honest with you, lies in getting a sense of whether... See, because I do think there is this tendency, especially among academics, to kind of use neoliberalism as a sort of stalking horse for everything they don't like about the system, without imagining that there might be a coherent ideology there that might have some attractive features that may not be executed properly, you see, but you have to, in a sense, see what the ideal is supposed to be about, right? And where is it located in political space, right? You have to kind of get a sense of that. And so then when you go to the real life politics where the stuff fails, right, then in a sense you can say, okay, it's failing, you know, in what sense is it failing according to its own ideals? Because I agree with you, actually. Right, I agree with you that if we were much more in the spirit of neoliberalism, we would not have bailed out banks, okay, for example. Okay, I mean, but obviously neoliberalism doesn't exist in a vacuum, even when it's in power. And so there are a lot of other issues at stake.
So if you take Jamie Peck, for example, he would answer this, and I think I agree more with his conception, which is rather than treating neoliberalism in ideal, typical terms, you understand it specifically through this tension between its ideal manifestation and then the reality of it coming up against different social, political, economic constraints. And to understand neoliberalism not as an ideal type, but rather a process of crisis management and responses to that. That seems to fuse those two different...
No, I see what you're saying. I guess in terms of my own thinking, and because I do think I want people to keep... to feel a bit kind of concerned about neoliberalism, I like to think of it as a kind of sibling to various kind of leftist movements. Okay, in terms of spirit, it's just with a somewhat different conception of the human being, but in terms of the willingness to use state power to reorganize the economy and so forth, it's very similar. And it's very different from a traditional Tory paternalist kind of view. Okay, and I think, so in that respect, this is why, in a sense, a kind of genealogy of this thing is quite useful, because it isn't so alien from those of us, from what those of us on the left think about.
Just one last question, yeah. Steve.
Just following up on that point, actually, about the idea of man, I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about this utopian neoliberal man, mm-hmm. and whether how that issue is debated, because I was really struck by what you were saying. It seems very persuasive that you look at the left revolutionary history, there's a very explicit discussion about what is the revolutionary man going to be looking like, and you look at Russia, or you look at China, mm-hmm. or Cuba, it's like our revolutionary man will be not alienated from themselves in the way that a capitalist man is, and we're going to build a society that allows them to fulfill those virtues, and what are those virtues, and that debate takes place. And it sounds like what you're saying is the neoliberal says that we're not going to make any presumptions about what those virtues of the neoliberal man are, and yet there seems to be almost a kind of, it's sort of almost like a Straussian critique of liberal relativism that could be made, that actually they're saying they're not assuming anything, but there's one thing they're being absolutist about, which is that the way to get to this individual is through competition. And so they're saying everything is relative, absolutely everything is relative. And that seems to me a point where theoretically their idea of not presuming the nature of man sort of falls into itself.
Yeah, unless you kind of have this rather, and this is where people like Ayn Rand start to get some mileage, right? You know, kind of Promethean, I know, look, I'm not endorsing this stuff, I'm just putting it out there for you, but this idea, this Promethean idea of the human being, right, you know, I'm a god unto myself, right, I can be anything, anyone, if people don't stop me.
Just remember what happened to Promethean.
No, I understand completely, but I'm just saying, you know, in terms of what the vision is, right, because so there is a vision, as it were, that everyone can have in their minds, which is compatible with the kind of open-endedness. And you know, with this, and there, I think there's, you know, you could, there's an interesting, I know everybody finds, you know, Ayn Rand, I can't stand this stuff either, but I do think one, to really understand this, right, what is the philosophical anthropology, you might say, of neoliberalism, and what kind of an image of the human do you have? I think you need to look at the way in which, let's say, especially the various kind of neoclassical economists and Austrian economists respond to somebody like Ayn Rand, who likes her, who doesn't like her, some do, some don't. And I think that kind of interaction would be quite a useful thing to sort of tease out the sort of issues you're talking about.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. So if everyone's joined, saying thank you for
Thank you.